Welcome to International Tax Bites, a series of conversations around issues and concepts in international taxation. I'm Graham Jackson, and I'm a Gibraltar and English solicitor with Hassan's International Law Firm in Gibraltar. Today, I will be speaking to my podcast partner, Harriet Brown, who is a Jersey advocate and English barrister with Old Square Tax Chambers in London.
So, Harriet, here we are.
We are back for, I think, is this the first recording of this year? I can't remember.
It is the first recording of this year, and it's a long-awaited guest, isn't it?
It is, yes, and somebody who I am, and I'm sure you are too, absolutely delighted to have here.
I am very excited, and I'm not just saying that. In the conversations that you and I have had before, the word rock star of tax, or the phrase rock star of tax, has come up. I think it's...
It has, yes, and we're very, very grateful.
So we have the fantastic Rita De La Feria, who is the chair in tax law at Leeds University, and her background is that she did her first degree at the University of Lisbon and a PhD from Trinity College, chair in tax law at Durham University, senior research fellow at Oxford, and I mean, just a list as long as your arm of visiting professorships, and has advised numerous governments, including Sao Tome, Angola, Turkey, Portugal, obviously, written for The Guardian, appeared in the BBC Panorama. I mean, it's two pages. Her profile on a university website is two pages long. We can't cover it all, but we're very, very happy to have you here, Rita.
Thanks, Graham and Harriet, for having me.
So what we're going to talk about today is what is tax for, which most people would sort of think they understood. But when you actually drill down to it, it's quite a big question. So recently, Rita, you had an op-ed in The Guardian, didn't you? Which is, I think, is what triggered us to talk today. And you covered a lot of ground in that around what we think tax is for and the compromises that we need to make to achieve those goals.
Yeah, so I think that a lot of the discussion around tax policy and tax generally are framed in absolute terms, as if it's all good, all bad. And the truth is the majority of tax policy options are, in essence, a trade-off on comparative advantages. So giving the aims that you have is A better than B is most times the assessment that you have to make. So I think that nuance discussion is just lost usually on debates about taxes. And the more people argue about it, the more entrenched they tend to become in their views. This is a well-known behavioral phenomenon. So with the op-ed article, my attempt was to kind of give some nuance to that debate and make people think a little bit more about what are the trade-offs, what are the priorities, and how would we best achieve those priorities.
So that's what you're essentially saying is that we need policy objectives that we understand, and then we use tax to help us get there. So most people would understand tax as being the policy objective that tax has is to pay for things. And that was why tax was income tax in the UK was introduced, wasn't it, to fund the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, that's what everybody gets taught the first time they hear the words income tax, isn't it? So
I mean, it's interesting, actually, Graham, because I think an awful lot of taxes initially started out as ways to fund wars, if you go right back into history. So, yes, it's that's certainly been a starting point for a lot of tax back in the distant mists of time.
A lot of taxes start life hypothecated, is that the expenditure is allocated to them, linked to them before they're introduced. So it's not a tax, but one of the interesting examples in recent years is that FATCA was tied to paying for the Hire Act, wasn't it? It was the revenue raising scheme that went along with the job stimulus package in the Hire Act. So a lot of taxes start life like that, but in general, it just sort of gets subsumed into the into the general expenditure of the state, and so we sort of lose that link, don't we, between the policy objective and the tax. And so people just think that what we're doing is, in general, paying for services, when tax does have policy impact. Rita, you raised an interesting point when we were talking before we started recording, that paying for things is not just simple as paying somebody's wages. It impacts on redistribution as well.
Yeah, so I think that there is various kind of dimensions to what you just said, Graham. So first of all, I don't think that the paying for general budget is dissociated from paying for specific things. It's just that we don't list those things. When we say, you know, paying for stuff, what do we actually mean paying for stuff? Paying for stuff could be medical expenses and healthcare. It could be education. It could be defense and wars, as you just mentioned, but it could be also crime prevention, crime combating. So there is a whole range of things. The issue is that we tend to often not list them as such. So as the concept of state evolved over time, we stopped necessarily allocating to just specific expenses, and we just started having like a general budget that encompasses all of these kind of previous named aims that you were talking about. So I think that sometimes when we discuss, just because we don't hypothecate them to a specific objective, and by the way, you know, general perspective from public finance scholars of this is that hypothecated taxes are not the best way to do public expenditure. But just generally speaking, just because you don't hypothecate or you don't allocate to a specific named expenditure doesn't mean it's not paying for things that you want. It just means that we're not listing them. So that's kind of the first kind of point that I wanted to make on what you were saying. The second is that the part of the issue is that is not so much that at that level of detail that we decide about tax policy. So it's not necessarily we want to increase budget on healthcare or we want to increase budget on defense, but it's kind of a more, when I talk about kind of objectives, I'm talking about bigger issues. So not necessarily I want a better healthcare, but what do we want the tax system to achieve? And first of all, we need to decide on a broader picture. Is it just to increase expenditure on specific sectors? So do we want to, in essence, mobilize revenue? Do we want the tax system to increase, for example, or to decrease inequalities? Do we want the tax system, and you gave me this example when we discussed this prior to the podcast, do you want a tax system to regulate behavior of consumers? So the first, before we even start to discuss like the details of where we want to spend money on and what our priorities in terms of spending money on, we need to have kind of broad objectives of what we want the tax system as a whole to achieve. And once we have that, we will have to consider the trade-offs between those objectives. So sometimes those objectives are contradictory in themselves. So for example, fighting inequality or protecting the poorest might be contradictory to regulating people's behavior, for example. So there is, even within those kind of broad objectives, there is trade-offs between those objectives. So I think that we need to take the discussion kind of step by step. First, kind of decide what we want overall the tax system to do, then decide how those objectives interlink, and then we kind of bring it down to a more specific level of expenditure versus taxation. Where do we want to spend the money on? Where do we want to tax more, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that kind of systematic approach to tax policy, where you kind of have this broad picture And then you kind of go step by step down into level of specificity. So you go from more abstract to more concrete. That kind of step by step approach is often lacking in tax policy discussions.
So I can certainly see from a simplicity perspective that going from the abstract to the specific is possibly helpful. But isn't there an argument for saying that it's more of a feedback system? Because I think you, to take an example that you gave, you said, oh, well, we need to decide first, do we want to, say, protect the poorest in society? And you would hope the answer to that would be yes. But really, in terms of what that means, and if you sort of take some of the things that tend to come up in the UK, because that's what I'm familiar with around elections and things like that, as a general rule, people do not love money being spent on benefits. So they may well say, well, I'm all for protecting the poorest, but I don't want it done in that way. And these things feed into a policy discussion of each other. And that's my first question. Is there any argument for saying that it needs to be more of a feedback system rather than a top-down sort of system in terms of how we look at this? And secondly, we've talked about how taxes have tended to develop from sort of specific aims. So Graham gave the example of the income tax in the UK. The first income tax in the US was to fund the American Civil War, so another war-based one. Australia, again, when they first had a federal income tax, that was the First World War. Is the tax system really a tax system based largely on taxes that were initially developed to raise money for wars? And that's what income tax has done. Sorry, can I finish? To do that, is that really the best way to address all of these policy issues? Or would we be sensible in an ideal world to say, look, we need to look at how we do this all together again? Just readjusting and evolving income tax, say, is not necessarily the best way to meet such different priorities like protecting the poorest or reducing inequality.
Okay, so on the first question, my answer, I probably, I'm sorry to say, would be no. And the reason why I would say no is because I think the point that you're making is a valid point, but it's not really a design policy point, but it is about the political economy of tax policy. So to what extent will people accept specific tax policies depending on the way that tax policy is framed? So if you say protecting the poorest or giving welfare benefits, you're achieving the same objectives. The issue is how you frame that question. So
what I perhaps didn't say, there are a number of ways that you can protect the poorest. So someone might say, well, I don't think people should get welfare benefits, but I might be in favour of, or I think people should get minimal welfare benefits, but I might be in favour of increased tax breaks, or they shouldn't get welfare benefits, but we should have the best healthcare system in the world that is available to them absolutely free at point of use so that they are as healthy as they can be, so that need for benefits comes down. And to me, those things sort of feed in. And I'm sorry, I only interrupted you because I didn't necessarily explain that terribly well, or possibly at all.
So it is true that people have different perspectives on how the money is spent, and that frames their perspective on tax policy. But if you want to design tax policy, you have to first understand what the objectives are and then how people will understand those objectives. So whether you spend it on, so to put it another way, so whether you spend it on improving universal healthcare or whether you spend it on welfare benefits is an expenditure decision that will impact perhaps on public's buy-in to the tax policy, but it doesn't really change the tax policy in itself. So you'd need money for both aspects. You need money to give universal healthcare, and you need money to give welfare benefits. How you decide to spend that money may frame people's buy-in to the tax policy. And it goes a little bit back to Graham's point about hypothecated tax, right? So if you say to people, we are going to do this because we want to increase expenditure on the healthcare, maybe you'll have a bigger buy-in for that tax policy measure. But it doesn't change the nature of the tax policy objective. The tax policy objective is still to collect more revenue for revenue mobilization.
I think maybe the question that I've asked in a really roundabout way is how important is buy-in is taxpayer buy-in to tax policy, and how much does that need to be taken into account in policy? And maybe I've come at that from completely the wrong direction, but maybe that's sort of what I was driving.
It's massive, isn't it? Because it affects the tax morale, and that tax morale affects compliance rates, and that affects revenue raised.
Yeah, so I think that traditionally scholars have of tax policy scholars, so both from an economics and the law perspective, have been very reticent to take into account political economy considerations. I have for a long time defended that this is a fundamental dimension of tax policy design. So I think, in essence, you can design the best tax policy possible. If you don't have buy-in, if you can't approve it, it matters for nothing. It counts for zero. So I do think that political economy considerations are fundamental to design tax policy. But you still need to have the overarching aims kind of clear in your mind. So you need to know what you want to achieve, and then you have to consider how the public feels or even how you frame it. Because as we were just discussing now, on this example of the welfare versus healthcare, the tax policy objective is still the same. It's essentially the same, which is to gather additional revenue. The issue is how you're going to frame that to the public in a way that ensures buy-in. And without that buy-in, of course, nothing can be approved. So I think that is a pretty fundamental point. I think political scientists are, of course, more aware of these dimensions, but they haven't traditionally looked at tax policy issues. We are starting now to see an emergence, a slow emergence of policy, political science studies on tax policy issues. I think this is a really healthy development in terms of tax policy scholarship. And I do think that as they start coming out, these studies, it will give kind of a bigger picture on tax policy, and it will allow everyone else that already was working in tax policy, economists, lawyers, etc., to have this input and to take more into consideration the political economy of this. There has been really some interesting factors coming out of political science books. I don't know if this is an area that we want to go into necessarily, because the podcast is kind of a bigger picture approach, but there has been some really interesting findings in the last couple of years coming from political scientists that frame policy, that should frame our understanding of tax policy.
The wider concept of tax morale and how people feel about the taxes that they're paying is both a political question, a sociological question, a technical question for people like you, Rita, and framing is obviously very, very important. I just want to give to go back to that framing question, to go back to a practical example which is happening right now or has been happening in recent weeks, the UK's introduction of the digital platform reporting regime, mm-hmm. which is very similar to DAC 7, which is essentially that eBay, Etsy, all those peer-to-peer selling digital platforms will be reporting what people's income on those platforms are to HMRC and to the, you know, the Portuguese authorities and or the Spanish authorities or whatever. I've seen that reported as the side hustle tax when it isn't a new tax. And I've got perfectly good, super intelligent friends liking posts on social media that say how disgraceful this new tax is and how it can't be right. It's just kicking the poor when they're down. And I'm sort of like thinking, but it's not a tax. Why is it being framed like it's a tax? It's essentially an anti-evasion measure, which if the media were talking about a corporate, they would be all in favor of. But because they're talking about little old dears that knit socks for children and sell them on Etsy, then that's a very different story for the media to tell. But it's policy-wise exactly the same thing. We don't want to encourage evasion and we should find ways to stop it. So it's that framing is vitally important to whether people are content or not content with things that from a technical perspective you look at and you think, well, that's an absolute no-brainer. I mean, of course the tax authority should have information on income and you shouldn't be able to hide businesses because you're dealing with a peer-to-peer platform. So I think the media is vitally important in that process of educating the public that essentially underlies what we've just said about framing.
Yeah, I think, okay, let me take a step back from what you're saying to kind of link to the point I was making earlier. So I was saying how political scientists now are starting to look at these issues. Before they started looking at these issues, another kind of great addition to tax policy in terms of kind of literature and scholarship was the psychologists and sociologists. And you have studies now going back about, you know, 15 years, 20 years, starting to look at kind of how people feel about taxes, the point of tax morale that you were talking about, and the psychology of taxes. And I think that this issue of the framing and the example that you just gave, Graham, is really goes to kind of some key points, I think, that have been bugging me for quite a while. And one of them is the fact that we only seem to care about non-compliance, whether it's evasion or avoidance, if it's done by big multinationals. But we don't care about the much more common evasion, which is done by small and medium-sized enterprises. And how that? Why is that? How does that play out in the media? How does the public feel about it? Is something that I find very interesting. I think that also the focus on corporate income taxes versus other taxes. For example, in this case, personal income taxes is also very interesting to mention. Why do we give so much attention to corporate income taxes on the media and the public, and we give less importance to our biggest, most important tax, which is personal income tax? So why? So all of these questions, which is to do with this kind of this reporting, so suddenly people realize that they have to pay personal income taxes on when they have a small business on the side. I mean, you know, for any tax person, this is just a kind of an insane conversation in the sense that, you know, we all have to pay taxes on our income. So this is just a given. So the fact that this has come as some kind of a surprise to the general public, it's is just in itself is kind of an interesting discussion, right? So the fact that the public seems to be surprised with having to pay income tax on some side business is interesting in itself. But yeah, so I think that there are all of these issues of framing are fundamental. I think this issue of your willingness to pay taxes, and who do you get taxes from? So who do you think should pay taxes? Which is tends to be someone that is not you, or that's yeah. not someone you know.
The rich.
It could be anyone. It could be the rich, the big multinational, the, you know, so someone that is not you. So this kind of phenomenon in a way is kind of the othering of taxes. So it is someone else that not you. So who is this person? Some other. Who is the other? Someone that is not within your like network. So someone that is not you, that is not your friends, that is not your family, etc. So this othering of taxes and the way this plays out in the media is quite interesting, and it goes to this issue of framing. So many interesting points on this story that about the way this pans out, this reporting. I find it, but I think the most fascinating thing for me in itself is that people thought they didn't have to pay taxes on this income.
What the listener won't be able to see, because we are a podcast, is that Graham and I have been nodding along and grinning at everything that Rita's just said.
I have so many conversations with people, and you say, "Oh, you're going to declare that?" But no. Why? I pay tax on my wages. Yeah, but you've just sold the family silver that you inherited from your granny, and you've made like £5 million. Do you not think you should put that as a capital gains tax return? Why?
Yeah.
It's the lack of knowledge. I think it goes to the tax morale. Tax morale is partly because people don't understand on even the most simple level. It's so frustrating. And then you end up explaining it to them because they look at like you're an idiot. And then you're the bad guy. As a tax person, you're evil because you punctured their balloon that they thought that they were okay and it was all going to be fine.
And I think one of the most fascinating things here, I've heard you speak before, Rita, and I'm going to apologise in advance in case I don't frame this quite correctly. So I'm going to give you a chance to correct me. But I think what I've heard you say is that when you talk to people and when you look at how people look at tax being paid, rich always start somewhere north of them, whether they're a billionaire or the very poorest in society. Rich is always someone somewhere just north of what they have. As you say, it's this othering of tax. And I always find it fascinating that people are so keen to crack down on corporate tax avoidance, which is obviously legal, albeit you're going to be slapped with the tax charge that you should have paid probably in most circumstances, but corporate tax avoidance, and yet are quite happy to facilitate or even participate in individual evasion, like having a business selling secondhand clothes on the side and not declaring any income from that.
Cash in hand.
Cash in hand, all that. And I find that very interesting, because that type of evasion, certainly, I think in most jurisdictions, is criminal. So, you know, it's been given that stamp of being worse.
There's something psychological, isn't there, about giving the plumber or, you know, other tradesmen are available, and I'm sure some will take cash in hand. Giving your tradesman £500 cash. That's sort of between us, and we're getting one over on the man. But then a large multinational, so that's illegal, large multinational doing something legal, that's clever, and people in suits being smart and tricksy. That feels, I think for most people, that actually feels morally worse than the criminal offence.
Just being outright dishonest. Yeah, no, yes. I find that incredibly bizarre. Because the criminal offence requires dishonesty.
They feel like it hides behind legality, and then it's somehow more dishonest.
I think it is not the legality issue that is motivating them, but it is the issue of them being big and powerful versus someone like us. Whoever the else is. So let me kind of try to break down the various things that you said. So let me start with Harriet's point about perceptions of wealth. So it's not me saying, so we know from various studies on people's perception of wealth that everyone thinks that they are middle class. So literally, so it doesn't matter if you're on the top 1%. Of course, we're not talking about multi-billionaires of the 0.1, but general population, everyone thinks they are in the middle. So even if you are on the top 1%, or if you are on the fifth decile, everyone is clustered in in the middle. And that has very serious implications for tax policy, because we tend to notice those that have more. So those that are rich are never those that are in our income bracket. So when you say, do you want, in abstract, do you want to tax the rich? Yes. Then you say, okay, but rich in our country, so the top decile of the income distribution says that rich in our country are people, that receive, let's imagine, 80,000 pounds or 80,000 euros a year. Oh, okay, but I receive 90 and I'm not rich. Because the tendency is always to compare us. This is a human trait. So we always compare ourselves with those that have more than us. So if you heard me talking before on this, Harriet, you have heard me saying something along the lines that if you had a dinner party and you have several people there, one of them has just bought a new yacht or, some obvious signaling of wealth. You may not remember anyone else in the party that had less than you, but you remember that friend of yours that has the new yacht. So in essence, we don't remember that there were, six other people in the dinner party that have a lower income than you. You remember just the one person that has a higher income than you. And this has really big implications, because depending on how you frame the question, you get a different answer. So this is kind of the first point I wanted to say on the various issues. That the second issue that I think is pertinent is this issue of tax morale. And the way we perceive evasion by the powerful, which is basically what we see as corporations. So big corporations. So one of the interesting things, and I think you will be sympathetic to this point, both of you, have you noticed how corporate tax scandals never talk about companies that are not retail facing? Wow. So the big corporate tax scandals are about retail facing companies. So companies that are brand recognized names. So it's Amazon or Starbucks or, Google, etc. But it's never companies like are huge, but are not retail facing. For example, Merck's or, some other big multinational that has mostly B2B transactions. This in itself is it's telling, because it speaks to this issue that people in a way almost anthropomorphize these companies, and they are like big, powerful citizens of the world. This is the way they perceive them, right? So I think in a way this discussion is really about the powerful versus the less powerful, and the more about that than about legal versus illegal. So we are against those that are powerful and take advantage, but we're not against those that are like us. So that's
Can I just draw that out, but with another thought that might add to that, and to add to the otherness, I think there's something about the non-national nature of those businesses that you talked about. Mm-hmm. There was a Vodafone scandal that did not, and Vodafone is obviously a British company, but the Vodafone scandal did not stick in people's minds like Amazon. It's always Amazon they go to, or Starbucks. It's always... or it feels like for me anyway that it's companies that are they're either of nowhere or of somewhere else that they're bothered about.
Yeah, so that is the issue of the othering again, right? So yeah. It's not one of us. I mean, you can still be against the powerful in your own country, but the sentiment is less strong, I guess, than if it's othered in two ways: other because they are powerful, and other because they are not from your own country. So there is something kind of quite powerful about saying someone that is not part of your group is taking advantage of you.
Yeah.
So if we kind of boil it down to kind of basic emotions that are at play in this story. So I think that there's something to that as well, Graham. The third point I think I wanted to make is about this issue of how we look at tax evasion from people in our kind of circle. And for a long time, we had this perception that people only paid taxes if they thought they were going to be caught. As in, so what was the biggest element on willingness to pay taxes was deterrence, in essence. We kind of now know that this is not the case. We have many studies that talk about tax morale and people's willingness to pay taxes. We know that there are many range of factors that determine people's willingness to pay taxes, including how they perceive public services, how they perceive... So broadly speaking, what I would say are endogenous factors and exogenous factors. So factors that are to do with the tax system in itself and factors that are to do with society as a whole but are outside the tax system. So we know that loads of things determine people's willingness to pay taxes. But there has been, we can detect now, a growth in overall an acceptability of tax evasion. So I just published with a group of colleagues a paper on political science where we actually test people's tax morale and people's perceptions of evasion committed by small traders. So we basically did a massive survey in the US and in France. And we give them examples of small businesses committing tax evasion. And in this particular case, it was restaurants and car dealerships. And we basically try to ascertain people's perceptions about the fraud committed by these small businesses. Do they think it's right? Do they think it's wrong? Would they be doing the same if it was them? And what we actually found was kind of against what we actually expected to find, to be completely honest. There is an overall perception that this is wrong. I don't think that that would have been the case even 20 years ago. So now people actually know it's wrong. Now, whether they are willing to tolerate it or not, so that this is, goes to the second part of the study, is a different, but people actually know that this, it is wrong to not pay taxes on the income a restaurant or a car dealership, etc., receives. Yes, Graham, sorry.
I was thinking that, so I think, thinking about what you just said there, what the cause of that greater awareness of tax evasion is. So the English case law during the war and just after the war, when the country was in crisis and had a greater need for tax, was quite strongly against the taxpayer, and the general mood was that people who were evading tax were undermining the joint effort of the war and the post-war recovery. And I'm thinking, I mean, I don't know when your study was conducted, but the general air of crisis that's existed since 2007, do you think that might be driving that greater awareness of tax evasion, that it's wrong? Because we really do need the tax at the minute, and when the crisis abates, that will abate as well.
Yes and no, because there was two questions to there was two part question to what you just said, Graham. So the first, just to clarify, the study was conducted in 2020. The paper was just published because, you know, academia takes time. But the study, the empirical element of the study was conducted in 2020. I think yes, that is partially a consequence of the 2007 crisis, but I think no, it's not going to go away. So I think yes, because I think a big determinant of the growth in awareness of the unacceptability of tax fraud has to do with the salience of tax. So it's not court cases, which only people like the three of us in this podcast look at. It really is about what popular art conveys, what the media conveys, what the news conveys. And tax was really not very salient for a long time in these issues. So I, when I started teaching tax 20 years ago, the people that came to my classes were overwhelmingly law students that wanted, that had, were commercially focused, that wanted to work in commercial law, and wanted to practice either as solicitors, barristers, etc. But it was with a commercial kind of professional career intent. This is not the case now. My classes are now with a very sizable, but still minority, but a very sizable minority of students that come to tax classes because they want to understand better how society functions. They have social justice concerns. They have protection and inequality concerns. So where do these students come from? And if you talk to them, you see that the source of it is something that they heard in popular culture. So something about media, something about news, something about portrayal on a movie, or etc. So it is something about tax havens, or is something about, you know, tax avoidance, etc. So what I think is driving this increased awareness is the increased salience of tax issues in popular culture and public discourse. And this is connected, I think, yes, to the financial crisis. So I think it's not the financial crisis in itself that gave increased awareness of tax issues, but the media reporting that, and then the public salience of the tax came as a consequence of the financial crisis. And then people start caring more because basically it's everywhere. So it's like this, so going back to this, to kind of things that are on the news at the moment. So this issue of the postal office scandal, it only gained political salience in essence when there was a TV program about it, right? Which is genuinely, you know, a despairing state of affairs. But it is clear that in terms of timeline that that's what happened. So yeah. It's
sad taxes. As well, because it has been bubbling for over a decade. I mean, there was a decent podcast in about 2018.
Yeah, I was going to say about 5 years ago. That's when I first discovered it.
Yeah, and even that didn't really get a lot of traction. There was a TV program about it. There was more than one. And
Panorama.
As you say, there was another one as well though. But then it's a fictionalized TV series that finally gets people to go, oh my God, this is horrendous, which it absolutely is.
But it paints it paints it more as it's the framing, isn't it? The TV series paints it as I can't remember the title. The title is Mr. So-and-so.
Mr. Bates and the Post Office.
Yeah, but it makes it, it, even in its title, it makes it a David and Goliath.
Yes, it does.
So I think that brings us to fairness, Rita, which I know Harriet's lip will curl at the conjunction of fairness and tax, right? But you're talking about the demographics of your students have changed from people that expect to wear a tie for the rest of their lives to people that maybe considering changing the world, to put it very bluntly, more social justice. And that means that the thought of fairness, instead of seeing tax as a series of technical rules to be considered, do they see it more as a tool to implement fairness? And if they do, what does fairness mean to them?
Yes, but not just about fairness, but about a better society. So I think it's not just about fairness, but a range of objectives. So for example, environmental concerns. So it's not just one thing, but it's kind of social objectives broadly constructed. On the fairness, the majority of people, and not just my students, when they came into my classes, because by the time they leave, they, of course, understand very well the debates. So not just the students, but I think generally there is a lack of awareness of what we mean by fairness. So this fair taxation is consistently branded as a slogan for tax policy. And I don't really know what that means. from a technical perspective. I don't know what fair taxation, just said in that way, means. I understand very well the objectives of fairness, but I think we talk about this issue as if it fairness is a monolithic concept, but it is not. It is a concept that has many dimensions, some of which are contradictory in themselves. So I don't know, when people say they want fair taxation, my immediate instinct is, what do you mean by fair taxation?
So this is something that I, whenever the word comes up, I rally against it, because I think that cynically, that when most people talk about fair taxation, what they mean is that they tend to look at it as being fair or unfair, and that being a sort of like a binary state, and unfair means I pay more than I think I should have to. And I think that's for all of us, I think in an individual's mind, that's quite often what is meant. And I think it's so important that there be some sort of dialogue about what fair means. And until you really have that conversation around what fairness is in this context, it's going to be very difficult to achieve or to sell.
That goes back to what Rita was saying right at the very start, that we need to work out what our policy objectives are.
Oh, great.
I hate to say I was right from the outset, but you know.
Well, I didn't say you were wrong. I just asked a question.
No, I to be honest, I thought it was quite nice the way it looped back to the start. But it's we need to work out what fair means. If we want to be fair with our tax system, we need to work out what fair means. And that means we need to work out what our objectives are. And if it's redistributing wealth from the top 1% to the bottom 1%, and that's fine, but we need to work out that that's what we want to do. Tax is, in a sense, a tool to deliver policy, right?
Yeah, yes, that's the short answer. But to elaborate a bit more, I think there's kind of two dimensions of fairness that are implicit in what you just said. One is kind of the horizontal fairness, so the sense that everyone that is in the same circumstances pay the same amount. The other is kind of this vertical sense of fairness, which is those that have more pay more and those that have less pay less. But even that just is talking about income and wealth. Is not really talking about the various dimensions of fairness. So you have issues of gender fairness. You have issues of racial fairness. So all of these issues have to be taken into consideration. So I am currently leading a massive kind of pan-European project on taxation and inequality, which involves a team of over 50 tax law professors from primarily Europe, but some from outside Europe, from the US, Canada, Brazil, Japan, China. And that project basically is looking from a legal perspective at precisely what do we mean by fairness. So even if we assume, and this is really a big leap, conceptually, philosophically, that by fairness we mean decreasing inequality. So even if we take the vertical element of fairness, even then you have very significant issues to contend with, right? So, for example, if you give tax credits that will decrease gender inequality, that might actually have a negative effect on income inequality, because it's women that are more well off that will take advantage of primarily or be benefited primarily from those policies. So there are, even within fairness, you need to kind of determine, first of all, what do you mean by it? And second, which ones are you going to prioritize? There has to be some kind of, in your mind, from a policy goal perspective, you still have to have some kind of idea of your hierarchy of fairness. So which one are you going to prioritize in detriment of the other? So going back again, looping back to a point that you made earlier, Graham, about the op-ed article that I wrote for The Guardian. And actually, I mentioned this in the context of the environment. So people say, oh, we want as a kind of clear objective for tax policy to foment kind of a very environmentally friendly, sustainable economy, et cetera, greener economy. But a lot of the tax policies that may achieve that are tax policies that are regressive by nature. So these taxes are by nature regressive. Now we can say that kind of in the medium to long term, the impact on the planet is such that this takes priority over the inequality issue. So we don't really care as much about inequality when the survival of the human race is at stake. We may say that, but we have to accept that there is a contradiction between the two. Right. So we have to accept that there is a trade-off between the two. And the in the op-ed article, I gave the example of the recent tax breaks for energy products that were approved in the UK for excises, but were approved in many other European countries, not just on excises, but on VAT cuts. I mean, we just gave a consumption incentive, a tax incentive to consume fossil fuels. So in essence, this is contradictory to our objectives of a greener economy. Now, it is completely legitimate from a policy perspective to say, yes, but protecting the poorest at this moment in time is more important. So that's completely fine. What is not completely fine is to not acknowledge that there is a contradiction between these two objectives. So it goes back to this issue. You have to have a clear discussion. You have to have, first of all, you have to have it clear in your mind, but also you have to have a kind of public discussion with careful framing about what is it that we want to do? What is it that we want our tax system to do?
That goes further than just tax though, doesn't it? Really? That's just, I mean, I think, does it, are you just essentially boiling it down to an appeal to better public policy making processes?
Sure, but I'm a tax policy expert,
and tax policy comes from that, right?
So I try to restrict myself to my area of expertise. So my area of expertise is tax policy. But yes, of course, this is.
As a tax policy person, don't get the correct inputs to be able to frame your policy, to be able to make your policy to the standard that's required. If the wider policy making process of prioritizing things within society isn't carried out by people who are well educated, have sufficient information, aren't subject to slogans, and instead are applying their brains to things, I mean, that it is just we need to be better as a whole at arriving at what our priorities are.
I do accept that is a way of interpreting what. But I just said, yes, it's true, of course, that this is about how better to do public policy. But in a way, I'm trying to kind of, so what is happening in tax policy is probably symptomatic of a bigger issue, of course. I feel less competent about talking about the bigger issue because this is really kind of more in the realm of political science than tax policy. But yes, from a tax policy perspective, these problems kind of manifest themselves. So we need to kind of be at least conscious of that these are issues. So sometimes what bugs me the most, so what I feel most uncomfortable with is not with the decision that was ultimately made, but with the lack of clear objectives and priorities to start with. So at least acknowledging that these are issues would be a good start for me. So whatever we end up in the end of the discussion, whatever policy, tax policy decision we make in the end, I feel a lot more comfortable with that policy if there was a clear kind of objective setting, a clear discussion about what it is that we want to achieve before we reach that policy. I mean, different people with different political views, etc., will reach a different solution. My biggest point of contention is the informed debate part.
Yeah. So I think to go back go on.
Sorry, it's a slightly sort of tangential point, but Graham got in first, so it may be slightly different or may not be. So one of I think when you talk about fairness and how to have a fair tax system, and one of the concerns that I have, and I'm not saying it's a well thought through concern, but one of the things that comes back to me a lot is tax is literally just about money. Well, brutally, it is literally just about money. And how, and some of the things that we're talking about, some of the things that you touched on, like the environmental, which is essentially potentially fuels an inequality between generations, and racial inequality and gender inequality, those aren't things that are only rooted in money. And I completely accept and acknowledge that possibly one of the only things we can do about them is to deal with them financially. Is tax not rather a blunt tool to do all of these social ends, or to reach these social ends, or to achieve these social aims? And I say that, sorry, particularly in the context of what we developed things like the income tax for, which was to pay for people's wars, which was, you know.
My answer to that is the way you say it is all about money, but the way we spend that money, it is about the construction of our societies. It is about a social aim, right? So the at the core of taxation is this idea that we all live in a society, we are all in this together, and basically we all pool our resources in order to make that society function, right? So there is the core social objective, even though you say it's just about, there is a core social objective to the concept of taxation. Now, whether you can extend that to other kind of not obvious expenditure policy aims. So, and you talk about tax as other social objectives that are not just to do with expenditure. It depends on what your opinion is. So taxes modify behavior. We have known this for many centuries. It used to be that taxes modified behavior by accident. In the last century, we have started using taxes to modify behavior on purpose. So in essence, that's what is happening with these environmental taxes, etc. We don't have windows in some buildings in the UK because of the windows taxes, right?
So I was just about to say the one we all go to in the English tax system.
In the English tax system, it is. But yeah. If you go to Amsterdam and you see these narrow buildings, you were also told that you have narrow buildings because of property tax on land. So it was the food. So there is a whole history of taxes modifying behavior, but it used to be by accident. So until a smart person in the 1920s, Pigo, wrote about how basically you can modify behavior on purpose, and you can internalize the costs to society of consuming specific items or specific tax policy. So we have, in the last century, we started using tax on purpose to modify behavior. What behavior you want to modify really depends on your kind of political and social views. So I think it is legitimate to consider taxes to modify social behavior on as regards the environment, or modify social behavior as regards prevention of healthcare prevention, or whatever you can, or gender equality, etc. Whether I think it is legitimate to use those taxes for that, whether you want to or not, it depends on your political views and what your assessment is of the trade-offs. So is this more valuable than that? So on balance, do I think that this is a good way to do it, or there are other instruments that are better, that can be better to achieve that policy aim, right? But I think it is a viable discussion. That's basically what I mean. So whether you think it's the best way or not the best way. So I often say this about aims. So just because the policy aim is meritorious doesn't mean that the tax instrument that you're using to achieve it is the best tax instrument. So you have to dissociate the aim from the instrument, right?
Yeah.
So do I think that these tax policy instruments are viable to discuss those aims? Yes. Do I think they are the most appropriate? It depends on the specificities. It depends on your political views, etc. But I think the discussion is valid. Yes.
So it seems then that what we're saying is it's like a two-stage process. First of all, you set your policy aim. Mm-hmm. You have a proper understanding of what that is. And then you look at, is tax the right tool to do this with? And then you look at the actual implementation of the tax and whether that tax will achieve the policy aim.
I actually think
so. Three stages.
So you first decide the policy aim, then you decide if tax would be the best way, and then how would you frame that tax in order to achieve that policy aim, taking into consideration loads of trade-offs, as we were saying. Yeah. So that there is trade-offs to using tax or trade-offs within tax, etc.
So then, in answer to our question, what is tax for? I think we've come to the conclusion, because we've been speaking for quite a long time now, and we could do all day. Yeah. What tax is for is whatever we decide the policy is, it's for that, but we need to do that properly, and we need to work through the thinking properly and understand that there's trade-offs and it can't do everything. It isn't a magic bullet. It can't do everything, but it can. It is for what we decide the policy to be.
In essence, yes. So
obviously
there is revenue mobilization objectives that are common to every tax on earth. What do you mobilize the revenue for depends on your political options, of course, but there is a universal objective of using taxes as revenue mobilization. But within that broad framework and other policy objectives, how do you do it, or how do you attain other policy objectives? I think that it is whatever we want it to be. And the biggest, most important thing of all is to have clear in our minds what that is and what are the trade-offs of achieving those policy aims. I think that the discussion in absolute terms is something that we have to move away from. Nothing in tax is black or white. There's all these shades of gray. And we just need to decide where we want to be on that kind of grayscale.
I think on that note, that's a great conclusion. We could just leave it there. That's exactly where I'd like to. Rita, thank you so much for coming on. I know we've been trying to get you on for about 2 and a bit years, I think. Thank you so much for finding the time in the middle of your day to talk to us for an hour and a bit. I know we were a bit chaotic at the start, but thank you very much for coming. It's been really, really enlightening, Harry. I don't know I can see your face. I know you agree.
Rita, it's been absolutely fascinating and I'm so grateful. And I'm only sorry because I have at least 17 other questions I would like to get your answers to. But, you know, we're so grateful for the time that you've given us just now. And I'm just coming away from this again with a fantastically different perspective. And even as a practitioner, where a lot of the time we are just plodding through what we've got, it is really useful to think about these things in a different way and to have somebody as erudite as you to guide that thinking. So thank you.
Well, thank you for having me. I just would like to clarify what Graham just said about the 2 years. So when initially Harriet and Graham invited me to come on the podcast, my impression of the podcast was that this was primarily directed at practitioners and that it was really about kind of more concrete elements of tax law. And I haven't been in practice for over 20 years. And I thought that I was totally out of skill, really, to be able to talk about kind of the details of what it means to be a practitioner. And then Graham came back to me at a certain point and said, actually, we would like to discuss kind of a bigger policy issues. And it's okay. So that's more my field.
It was my fault. I wasn't
This is
clear.
Where I feel this is where I feel more comfortable talking about. So thank you for having me. Thank you for your patience and kind of adjusting to my area of expertise.
It's really important that practitioners listen to people who talk about policy.
Absolutely.
One thing this podcast has taught me, and it started when we spoke to Sven Steinmo, whose name kept appearing in my head when you were talking about sociologists, talking about tax morale. I desperately wanted to mention him. That opened my eyes and stopped me thinking of tax as a simple series of rules and flowcharts to follow, and started me to see it as an organic part of our society and our political system. This podcast has really helped me, and hopefully the listeners see that it's much more than just the yellow book and can I get a capital allowance for this or whatever.
Yeah, so I'm hoping that, generally speaking, that a lot of this kind of public engagement activities that I do, including on social media and in presentations and et cetera, not just this podcast, but is that raise this kind of awareness that you're talking about, Graham, yeah. We really need people to understand better, the public to understand better, that this is really at the core of how our societies are organized. And if we just reduce it to, you know, a very, very basic discussions about, you know, this rule, that rule, this tax cut, that tax cut, you just lose the kind of this big picture. And once you look at the big picture, it's a really, truly fascinating thing. I mean, did we humans agree to this? We got together and decided that we were going to pool resources into constructing societies the way we know them now. It is a fascinating thing.
Well, thank you very much for your efforts in raising that awareness. You are one of the, I don't want to sound too sweet about this, but you are one of the best in the world at what you do, Rita. It's definitely, everybody acknowledges it. And thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We're blown away to have somebody as well-known and erudite as you come to talk to us. And thank you for answering all my questions so patiently and good-humouredly.